When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and wonders how much of that money you get for climbing one whole place in the Premier League table. I'm Kevin Day and he is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Sorry, Kieran, that was insensitive of me talking about climbing the Premier League table.
I can only apologize, actually, Kevin.
Well, you never know, you could get a good result. I wouldn't say you made me, Kieran, but you so thoroughly recommended that I watch the Fulham Brighton game. You said this is going to be a game full of exciting, rapturous football and goals. So it wasn't. But having said that, having watched Palace Wolves yesterday, which was the opposite, it's questions day, Kieran. But we do have two news stories first. Both, I have to say, very heartwarming. One sad heartwarming and one happy heartwarming. A chap called David Clough died last year at the age of 78 and supported Rochdale for pretty much his whole life. And it was discovered this week that he's bequeathed his entire fortune to the club. The money will buy a scoreboard and air conditioning in one of the lounges and a new ceiling in a lounge. I mean, it's a wonderful story, Ken. Is this unusual? Because you see adverts for people asking, you know, other people to leave money in their wills for charities. But is this unusual for football clubs to benefit from wills?
Yes, very unusual. I mean, most people will have family. They will have causes which are close to their heart. So a football club could be within that. But this guy, his name is David Clough. And as you said, he was effectively Rochdale through and through as far as it can go. He worked in the local bakery. He didn't have a car. He cycled everywhere. But he still managed during his lifetime to raise over £500,000 just through selling the golden goal tickets and lottery tickets. So, you know, sadly, he died last June, and his estate has just announced, as you rightly said, that all of his proceeds in terms of his estate will be going towards the club for these things. And to be fair for the club, they're trying to retire his seat. I think Valencia did something similar when a fan. And what they're doing is that they're trying to raise money to get a statue which is going to sit in his seat forevermore. Brilliant. And that will be quite an eye-watering event. You know, it'll be very, you know, people will be upset but proud of him at the same time. To do all of that again, we talk on this show about the dark side of money in football, but it does give so much to so many, and I think this is a perfect example.
Yeah, and every club has got 100, 1,000 David Cloughs or Mabel Cloughs, haven't they? Fans that just very quietly get on with supporting the club, but as you say, sell the raffle tickets, turn up for things, do low-level good things all their life, and then decide that they want to do low-level good things for the rest of eternity, which is fantastic. I'm not sure I'd want to be the person who's sat next to his statue for the rest of eternity in the ground, to be honest. But it's a beautiful gesture, and we support David Clough. Palace are one of those many clubs that now have a little garden of remembrance where you can get your ashes scattered, which is rather sweet. Although I've made it quite plain that I want my ashes scattered on the pitch, preferably during a game. hopefully, as Palace have taken the penalty in the face of the opposing goalkeeper. That's how I want to be remembered.
Bit like the Great Escape.
A little bit like the Great Escape, and then you accidentally give yourself away when someone drops a needle and you speak English by mistake. I think I've summarised that film quite well, haven't I?
Yes.
As we saw yesterday, the Wolves boss, Nuno Espirito Santo, is a very generous man. 3 points, Nuno, thank you. It's very unexpected. But he has personally donated £250,000 to the club's Feed Our Pack food bank project, maybe, pardon. And people will say, Kieran, there will be cynical people going, well, he can afford £250,000. But that's an enormous amount of money that he's given to the food bank project. And I imagine the biggest donation that I've had by far. And that will make a substantial difference to people's lives in Wolverhampton. So hats off to him. That's a brilliant gesture.
Yeah, again, you know, the cynics say, well, as you rightly say, that he can afford it, but he didn't have to, and he did give the money, and he I think he was prepared to keep it low key. I think the club wanted to publicise it because it is an amazing gesture. I think we also have to give some credit also here to the Premier League, because they matched that. They set up an initial £250,000 grant to the club. And the Premier League does an awful lot of good work, which doesn't get publicised. You know, I think we've been very keen on food poverty due to the amazing work of Marcus Rashford as well.
Yeah, of course.
So, yeah, this is another superb illustration that people in football, in the form of the players and the managers, they get an awful lot of stick. But I'm not sure it's all that's warranted. You know, there's more good footballers than there are good football owners in many regards, and perhaps you know, people ought to cut them a bit of slack. Yeah, some young men do daft things, but if I was 22 again and earning that amount of money and having that sort of lifestyle, I'm sure I'd do daft things as well.
If I was the age I am now, earning that amount of money, I'd be doing daft things. It didn't have to be 22. I would welcome the opportunity. If you're listening, universe, I've written this sentence now. These are uncertain and difficult times for all of us. So we are going to be doing our best to bring you more stories like that. And that sentiment comes from Producer Guy. Producer Guy has said that we want to try and at least once a week bring a story of a wonderful financial gesture, or wonderful helpful gesture from people in football to the community. And when a multimillionaire venture capitalist like Guy recognises that there are good people in football, then I think that's wonderful that somebody like him has stepped out of the boardroom. He really is so different to the picture we paint of him, isn't he?
Yes, he is. He's the world's sweetest. I've never known him say a bad word about anyone or anything.
He's just the nicest little middle class man, isn't he? With that lovely, soft middle class man accent. We've just, and we'll continue to do so, painting him as a terrible, terrible hedge fund manager capitalist who has a gold sofa. It's question time. We've got some interesting questions this week, Kieran. We always do, but there's a very interesting range of questions this week. And the first one comes from Mark Locke. And we've not actually picked up on this, and I think it's something that is remiss of me, certainly, for not thinking of this. But Mark says, do you see the potential for non-league or lower league clubs to be compensated by the FA, or ideally the government, for loss of income due to zero attendances in the FA Cup?
I think there's zero chance of this happening. The FA have actually halved the amount of money that they're giving to clubs this season as a result of the losses that they incurred through the FA Cup final taking place in an empty Wembley Stadium. The FA has had the England matches take place again with no crowds. And it was hoping to make an awful lot of money from hosting Euro 2020. I think we'll come back to that in a little while.
Yeah.
So on the back of that, the FA has far less money. I think Gareth Southgate has taken a pay cut. There's been redundancies at various aspects of the FA. So the chances of that happening are zero. When it comes to the government, the government is not a huge fan of professional football, as we've seen in the form of the bailout that's been given to various sports in terms of the winter funds package. So they won't do that. I think they'd also be concerned that it will be setting a precedent which other senior sports, you know, clearly we've got the Aviva Rugby taking place, we've got the cricket season about to come upon us and so on. And if football is seen to be given an advantage, then those other sports would be requesting it as well.
It's I'm optimistic about vaccines and all sorts of things, and the future looks much brighter than the recent past, but the FA Cup will be starting again in July, August, won't it? So it's going to be very difficult for very low-level clubs who will be playing games July, August, September. If this still hasn't been resolved, they're going to be going into almost a third season of them getting no income from the FA Cup, which seems a bit harsh, doesn't it?
Well, given where we are at present, and I think we'll probably cover this story in more depth on Thursday with regards to the National League going in for a two-week hibernation. Mm. Football below the National League level has been suspended. We are pinning our hopes on the vaccine. If that hasn't come through, then there will be no preliminary rounds for the FA Cup in July and August because the government won't allow them to take place.
Right. I say all that, but what round of the FA Cup does money actually start kicking in?
It starts at the preliminary round.
Oh, it does? Oh, okay.
So every club that is successful, and initially I think it's those clubs that are participating, and then it tends to go on to the winner. But the money does start to ramp up. I mean, it's not huge amounts. I think for winning the fourth round matches, you've got something like £110,000, which clearly to a Premier League club is a relatively small amount. But to those clubs, you know, the likes of Chorley who got that far, it was significant. And on top of that, they were getting TV money on in addition.
Next question is from David Vesey. David says that many Premier League clubs now have their own club-based TV station. I can't recommend Palace TV highly enough. It's very, very good. And the guy that does most of the interviews is a very handsome, sarcastic vegan who's genuinely very funny. And there's a lot of quite imaginative content on there, as there are for most Premier League football clubs. But David says, as they all follow a subscriber model, I can't believe they'd be that popular when the major broadcasters already cover all the matches. So basically, it's two questions there. Are there people who actually only go to club websites to watch live games at a substantial cost? Or are these club TV things just being, you browse them for interviews and team news and whatever? And how much do they make out of that?
Right, trying to dig into the accounts was actually challenging because they're sometimes buried within the accounts of the senior clubs. I did take a look at the accounts of MUTV, and you'd expect Manchester United, with its global fan base, to be very successful. MUTV made revenue of £8 million in 2020. That's less than the gate receipts from two games, to put it in some form of context.
Okay, right.
And on the back of that, the club managed to lose 10 million. So even a club with the global appeal of Manchester United, it's struggling to find the right formula. And what they are looking for is the ability of the club to sell the individual match rights. And we've seen that in terms of both Project Big Picture, where the clubs, or rather Manchester United and Liverpool, let's be honest, they were the two clubs that were behind this scheme. They were going to start to sell their rights for eight games a season. And then if that was successful, I suspect the eight would have become all home games for all clubs. So I think that would be an issue. But until that is the case, it is difficult because there are so many alternatives, which are either more comprehensive in many regards. So you've got all the forums being run by fans. And we were talking only last week about the amount of money that was being generated by the likes of Arsenal TV, where it was fan-based and it was that much... It was more irreverent, should I say?
Yeah.
It wasn't towing the line. It wasn't trying to constantly persuade you to sign up for this, that, and the other, which I think fans get a bit fed up with. I mean, the only time that MUTV was ever of any interest was probably the infamous Roy Keane interview,
of course,
where that was probably his last ever word spoken, in as far as that channel was concerned, and within a couple of days he'd been packed off to Celtic. So there's not a lot to offer for a subscription model that you can't really pick up elsewhere on social media. Pre-season friendlies are perhaps one thing, if that's yeah, but I can't really get excited about exhibition matches. So trying to find a package which is worthy of the subscription fee, I think has proven to be beyond most of the clubs to date in terms of trying to generate extra money.
What's Brighton TV like? I imagine you probably have cooking programmes and adverts for second-hand Range Rovers, don't you?
That's right. Well, we've not got one.
Have you not got one?
No.
Really? In this day and age, why is that?
Well, they've got a they've got the website. They do interviews on the website. You can pay some sort of subscription, I think, for a slightly enhanced version, but nobody that I'm aware does it. It's trying to find value. The manager talks to the press twice a week before matches. The players get interviewed. You've got Twitter and the fans forums. How much football do you actually need?
Well, you need your own TV station if you're going to be taken seriously in this world, Kieran. But you know, fine if you want to just shuffle along with that half-assed, low-rent technology, that's fine. James Hobbs has asked the UEFA Euro question that you predicted would be coming up because you'd seen the list of questions as well.
Yes.
how does this man do this? Oh, yeah, he gets a question sent to him too. James Hobbs asks, what would the ramifications be for UEFA should Euro 2020 be cancelled completely? Or, yeah, I don't know whether they're going to be calling it 20. It's going to be confusing if they keep calling it Euro 2020 while the games are on. James wonders whether a fanless Euros is possible or a Plan B competition held in just one or two countries, as it nearly always is. I can't imagine, Kieran, that there won't be a Euro 2020 of some sort.
Yes, and the reason for this, it's going to be driven by TV, in my opinion. So of the options, unless things deteriorate significantly from a health perspective, UEFA will be desperate to have some form of tournament taking place. They have been sending out with increasing regularity emails to people who have bought tickets. And there was some confusion because when I got the initial email from them where it said that if the match moves to another place, we're not going to give you a refund. I said, well, you know, sod that. Yeah. So I demanded my refund. Then a week later, they changed their mind and said, if the match is taking, I think it's more than 50 miles or more than 200 miles from 200 kilometers from the initial place, you would get your money back if you wanted, which was a bit frustrating. So I'd have quite happily gone to Manchester or even to Dublin, perhaps, to see it, to see England play. But now I think that they are accepting that there's an increased chance of either no fans or, you know, we have seen fans attending some events. I think the Super Bowl, they're anticipating, yes, 22,000.
Yeah.
If we take a look at Australia, which appears to have dealt with the virus in a far more severe manner, and therefore it has far fewer cases. There were 30,000, I understand, at the MCG on Boxing Day. So if the governments give the go-aheads, and this could lead to, you know, some form of bubble competition where it's taking place in one or two countries. You know, we've certainly got the capabilities to do it here from a stadium point of view. Whether we'll be sufficiently along the route in terms of public health and safety is questionable. Russia hosted the 2018 World Cup, so therefore it might say, well, we're in a position to host this tournament.
Yeah.
There's a lot to be said there. If anybody's ever had a semi in Moscow, they will speak very highly of it, I can assure you.
Now, as you know, Kieran and I are two smooth operators. One of us, literally, because this episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by our below-the-waist grooming partner, Manscaped, which offers the finest tools for your family jewels.
Absolutely. And the Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0, which is their latest and greatest, includes the Lawnmower 3.0, which is waterproof, so you can play with it in the shower. It's skin safe, so that's going to reduce the likelihood of nicks on your two best friends. It even has a light which helps you to spot bits that you've perhaps missed otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And every lawn, Kevin, needs a bit of TLC. So as well as the lawnmower, you have the Crop Preserver, an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer, the Crop Reviver, which is a ball toner spray. And you put all of those together, and that's also going to help unintentional flossing. And on top that, we get a travel bag called The Shed and a set of boxer briefs, which are really good to reduce chafing.
That's a big package. And if you want to be hair-free, care-free, go to manscaped.com and get 20% off plus free shipping using the code PRICEOFOOTBALL. That's 20% off and free shipping with manscaped.com with the code PRICEOFOOTBALL. Can I just say, Kieran, I don't think we've had a pod yet where you haven't found some way of crowbarring in the suggestion that the Euro should be played in Moscow. Basically, even in 2018, you were saying, let's not have it all over Europe. I'd just have it in Russia. It's been great in Russia. I don't know if UEFA have considered this as an option. Probably not. But if Australia could be in the Eurovision Song Contest, why can't we have the Euros in Australia?
Well, that actually could be a solution. Whether Australia would be over keen on 24 teams arriving. But if you take a look at the way that they've dealt with the Australian Open from a tennis perspective, you know, the players there haven't looked entirely happy because they have to quarantine for 14 days inside a hotel, so they can't actually practice their tennis. It wouldn't work for football. So finding a country which has had a successful treatment of coronavirus, there's no need for it to be in Europe. The only thing that could be an issue is that matches would be taking place local time there, yes, at 3 a.m.
Yeah, broadcasters wouldn't be happy. I presume, Kieran, there's two questions for you here. Obviously, if there are no Euros, refunding everybody who's already bought tickets would be a massive logistical operation. And also, secondly, are all tickets priced in Euros for the competition? When you bought your tickets, did you pay for them? Was the price in Euros or was the price also in sterling?
No, the price was in Euros. I think it worked out. I think it was €185 a tip.
Wow.
A ticket.
€185 a tip. No, that is breaking up some memories. just a tip, please. Thank you. Okay, so but the refund then, that would be a huge logistical operation, wouldn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, because everybody's booked online, in terms of the people who have already requested refunds, UEFA have said it's going to take 4 to 6 weeks to get that done. If you take a look at the likes of, you know, EasyJet and Ryanair, they've had to give millions of refunds out, and they've managed. So it should be within the capability of UEFA to do this, because it's a big logistical exercise to send out the tickets. So you know, this is actually easier because you don't have to physically send them out. I think there's one issue which I don't think UEFA have really come to terms with. Since buying the tickets, and you had to buy them, of course, at least a year early, so people were buying them in 2019, many people will have moved houses, their credit cards or debit cards will have expired. Mm. So getting the money back could result in that. That's where the practical and logistical problems are going to arise, because what are you going to do under those circumstances?
Well, also, and this is a horrible thing to say, many people who bought tickets will no longer be with us, will they? Which is, again, an issue, I presume.
Yes. I mean, in theory, their bank accounts could be still outstanding, right. You know, because the estate will be dealing with those. So UEFA should be able to get money into the bank accounts, which are linked to the relevant debit or credit cards.
Right. Our next question comes from Larkin Hogel, who wins Name of the Year so far, hands down.
Did you see the Dutch footballer yesterday who scored 4 goals for FC Den Bosch?
No, Kieran, I don't even look at the championship in England. Really, I'm a Premier League football fan. I don't know. Do other leagues still exist, do they?
What was his name? His name is the greatest name I've ever seen in football, Jiz Hornkamp.
That's a great name.
Can you imagine that? I mean, it's just as well in the Dutch, it's only in the Eredivisie that players have their names on their shirts, because wandering around with jizz on the back of your shirt isn't going to help, is it?
Not in most circumstances, no. This is going to sound comparatively tame compared to your filthy example, but there was I believe he was a Belgian defender called Mark de Man. Which is a great name. Anyway, back to Larkin Hogel with his brilliant name. Larkin's question is about Champions League payouts, and simply put, how do they work and do they affect clubs differently? And as an example, Larkin says, what did Ajax receive from their magical semi-final run 2 seasons ago, and was that enough for them to reinvest significantly? And Larkin is obviously in Hungary because he said our Hungarian champions, Ferencváros, are likely to finish last in the Champions League group. Is it better to finish last in the Champions League group than win a couple of games and get into the Europa League? This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. What if you had access to tomorrow's tools today? In Notion, you do. It's the AI-powered workspace where any team can turn ideas into action.
My career is sort of a bit like being a butterfly, and I'm always jumping from project to project. So therefore, Notion helps me from summarising meetings notes and automatically generating action items to getting answers to any question in seconds. If you can think it, you can make it. And Notion is for everyone, whether you're a Fortune 500 company or a freelance football finance lecturer.
You can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Right, the payment system is very complicated. What UEFA do is that they have, first of all, what's referred to as a club coefficient, and that that measures the relative success in European competition over the course of the last 10 years. So therefore, if you are, let's say that Chelsea don't qualify for the Champions League this season, they will still get money from a Champions League pot because they've qualified in previous years. This is all part of the attempt by the big clubs to secure as much of the money as they can. On top of that, there's something called a market pool, and this effectively works along the lines of the more money your domestic broadcaster gives to UEFA, the more money the domestic clubs take out of it. So English clubs and Scottish benefit because BT pay more for Champions League rights than any other broadcaster in Europe. So therefore, English clubs collectively between them take more money out. That works. That works quite well. In terms of Ajax, they earned 78 million euros in 2019 for getting to the semi-finals, whereas Manchester City, who only got to the quarterfinals, still earned 93 million.
Oh, okay.
Because BT put more money in. There's lots of things. And then in the group games, everybody gets a set fee, which is around about 15 million euros. But on top of that, you get, I think it's 2.7 million euros for a win and 900,000 for a draw. So even if it's a dead rubber, in theory, the manager or probably get a team talk from the finance director saying, come on, lads, this match actually does make a difference to the club as a whole. So it does get quite messy in terms of the overall numbers. The money in the Champions League is more beneficial by a substantial amount. It gets about four times as much money as the Europa League. So therefore, if you take a look at clubs such as Napoli, who got knocked out of the group stage of the Champions League in 2019, they still made more money than Chelsea and Arsenal, who contested the final of the Europa League.
Right, and what about Larkin's question about whether Ajax reinvested that money significantly?
Yes, they did reinvest it in terms of wages and so on. I mean, Ajax is a very successful club from a financial point of view, mainly to do with its sort of development profile. Having said that, Ajax normally makes less money than the, you know, with no disrespect to our clubs, it will in a normal season, Ajax will generate less money than the likes of Palace and Brighton, because the Dutch TV deal is minuscule compared to that of the Premier League.
Yeah, I bet Ajax have got their own TV company, TV channel, just like Palace, just saying. Still on the Champions League, well done, producer guy. He may be an evil capitalist, but he can put questions together like anybody. Graham Stanton wonders whether it would be possible to share some of the Champions League cash among the rest of the Premier League or even further down through solidarity payments. Obviously, he says UEFA wouldn't be keen to give money to clubs not in the competition, but if the Premier League is one club, one vote, they could possibly argue and force that through, could they?
They couldn't, because the Premier League are only allowed to vote on issues which relate to Premier League distributions. Now, as this is a UEFA distribution, that this would be an area which they can certainly talk about at the monthly meetings that they have, but the other 14 clubs wouldn't be able to do anything in regards to this. And as we were hinting at earlier, this is actually going directly in the opposite direction to what the large clubs in the Premier League want. If you take the big six, on average, they earn £350 million a season more than the other 14 clubs in the Premier League. And the argument that they're putting forward through both Project Big Picture and the European Super League is that £350 million isn't enough of a financial advantage, and they want more. So, you know, it's pure Gordon Gekko land in terms of, you know, the love of money and the love of greed. And it does impact upon competitive balance as far as the Premier League is concerned.
Our next question comes from Matt Linborn. Hello, Matt. And Matt reminds us of the terrible death. There's no need for me to say terrible death. It reminds us of the death of Emiliano Sala, and wonders if there are any updates on what is happening and who is liable. This was a subject we talked about briefly when we first started the pod, but Matt's a Cardiff fan and says to his knowledge, they've yet to pay any money to Nantes. I mean, this, I think one of the things we agreed on, Kieran, very early on was that nobody was coming out of this with any credit. And it's a story that has gone very quiet, hasn't it?
It has. And in fact, I think it was the 21st of January 2019. So it's now 2 years since the death of Emiliano Sala. There has been talk of setting up a memorial trust. I believe Cardiff have contributed towards that. Yeah. They've asked Nantes and they've also asked the agent to contribute, but it's all gone very silent from the other parties. The family are still asking for a start date for the inquest into his death. You know, and that's terrible. You know, we appreciate COVID has not helped anybody trying to do any form of investigative work, but not to be even given a start date.
Yeah.
The only thing that we have had is the Air Accident Investigation Bureau report. And in terms of the relationship between Cardiff and Nantes, this did go to the Court for Arbitration for Sport or something similar. And I believe that Cardiff have been forced to pay the first instalment of the transfer fee, which I think was around about £5.4 million.
Right.
But whether they are liable for the remainder is yet to be determined, because as we've said, sadly, on more than one occasion, this is a young man. Yeah, this is somebody's son, somebody's partner, somebody's brother, and all of these things. As far as the two clubs are concerned, he's a contract, and he's a contract that both parties are trying to weasel their ways out of. And as you rightly said, nobody's coming out of this with any credit in terms of some of the stuff which has been put out in the public domain from all parties. And it's an embarrassment for the game, the way that the clubs at times, and as for his agent, just don't get me started on that.
Yeah. And as you say, the important people here are the young man himself who lost his life and his family who can't do it, are left in limbo until basically footballing authorities and football clubs stop spinning this thing out and resolve it some way or other. I worry that this time next year and this time the year after that, Matt Linborn will still be saying, has there been any progress about what's happening, which is depressing to say the least. Ryan Garcia, he wins second best name of the week. Sorry, Ryan. Larkin just pipped you to the post. But Ryan Garcia says, with income being heavily affected due to COVID, how do kit manufacturers' deals work at the moment regarding payments? Do they normally receive one lump sum payment up front, or will it be staggered throughout the year or throughout the contract?
There will be elements of everything in what Ryan's just said. Normally, the kit manufacturer will make an upfront payment before the launch of the kit for the season. And that's partially to be contractually agreed. The kit manufacturers, especially at the upper end of the scale, they are fully aware that if they give the club money before the sort of the transfer window is in play, it's actually in their interest to do so as well, because it's going to assist the club in being able to go out and sign players. That increases social media interest. That increases kit sales. But in terms of the overall nature of the deal, there will be a fixed element on the deal itself. Plus, there will be a commission for every piece of merchandise sold. And I think we've spoken that on average, football kit deals generate around about a 7% commission for football clubs. But Liverpool have taken an innovative approach that they've received less money from Nike, or Nike, depending on how you like to pronounce it, than their preceding deal from New Balance. But I think they've got a 20 to 25% commission. And they've done their sums, and they believe that with Nike's marketing power and also its roster of sort of, you know, AAA plus sports stars who can be used to promote the Liverpool brand, especially in the States, that they will make more money that way. But clearly, you know, football kit sales, you know, nobody's given out the numbers as yet. It's difficult to have the spontaneous buys of football kit after a match when you're watching it on television. You know, I've been known to buy some absolute tat in our mega store. I've always wanted a purple and lime green t-shirt with the club logo on, because we've just beaten, you know, Burnley 1-0 or something. Those spontaneous purchases aren't taking place. So I would imagine for most clubs, sales are probably down. You know, for some clubs, you know, Leeds have done extremely well on the back of being promoted, but it will be a bit hit and miss.
Kieran, you're colourblind. You may well have bought a purple and lime green T-shirt without realising it. You know that, don't you?
Yes, I find that out when I get home and the Baroness turns to me and says, do you know what you've done? I go, well, I thought it looked nice. It's bright.
Yes, while we're on that subject, we are collating some information about the economics as football relates, especially broadcast football relates to people with colour blindness, and you may have seen some tweet messages yesterday. So I think we will be trying to deal with the whole issue of colour blindness in football, because once again, Man United's away kit has been causing criticism. So we'll be looking at that in greater detail in a few weeks, hopefully. Two things off the back of this, Kieran. Firstly, I believe the ancient Greeks would probably go Nike. So if you can,
it's good enough for me.
If you can find an ancient Greek and confirm that. Secondly, you may well have told me this before, Kieran, but you know what my attention span is like. So, if for example Chelsea have a new kit deal, negotiate a new kit deal, would that also include the Chelsea women's team, or would the women's team negotiate a kit deal separately? Could they have a kit deal with a different manufacturer, for example?
Theoretically, yes, they could. But most of the manufacturers want a deal which is as broad as possible. What we are starting to see, and I think we'll come to this in a few minutes, is that the women's teams are now sort of breaking out away from the men's teams when it comes to issues such as sponsors.
Oh, do you know what? Subconsciously, I've just seen that question coming up. Subconsciously, that's probably what put it in my head. I'll just mentally make a note to rejig the way I asked that question. Gary Bignall asks our penultimate question. It's one of our shorter pods this week, but there's lots of football on telly. It's not today, it's yesterday, isn't it? Let's not get confusing. But you're listening to this on Monday or Tuesday. You can listen to it when you want. Don't take our word for when you have to listen to it. But you're definitely not listening to it on Sunday, which is when we're recording it. Confusing enough? Good. Gary Bignall. Now, this is an interesting question, Kieran, about somebody who was quite a high profile just a few years ago in lower league football. So Gary Bignall wants to know about Glenn Tamplin and his time at Billericay, which was very well publicised, especially around London and the South East and the media here. By all accounts, Glenn Tamplin invested upwards of £2 million into Billericay, then stood down as owner in September 2019 and subsequently purchased Romford. But Gary wants to know whether Glenn Tamplin still owns Billericay's ground or training facilities.
I don't think he necessarily owns them, but according to the most recent accounts, somebody, and Billericay's accounts used to be quite thorough and very entertaining.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
In what way?
Well, they sort of give, you know, the chairman's statement, never dull. Never dull at all.
Well, are you talking about accountant entertaining or normal person entertaining?
Well, as an element of both. I mean, for me, that there used to be plenty to get my teeth into. But the chairman's statement, you know, he was not shy of giving an opinion.
Oh, okay.
In the annual accounts. But where we stand at present, as Gary rightly said, Glenn Tamplin resigned as a director of Billericay Town Football Club Limited in October 2019. Now, unfortunately, in 2019, all of a sudden, the accounts became a lot less comprehensive in terms of content. So we used to know exactly how much he'd lent to the club. However, going into the small print, somebody is owed £1.75 million on an outstanding long-term loan. So he might not physically own the stadium, but if he calls in the loan, you know, then he would be entitled, if the club's not in a position to repay it, which it isn't at this, right, unless somebody else comes in, then he'd be entitled to, if he's got any form of security, to call in on the assets of the club. So it does look as if he has certainly a financial investment, and that could have implications for the club. There's no evidence that he wants to do anything of a negative slant. You know, he did have a good time there, and I think he would be reluctant to tarnish his memory of the time there by doing something of that nature.
So at that level, are you allowed to have a stake in more than one club then?
Yeah, loans and shares are different investments.
I see. Okay.
So he must have sold his shares, because you wouldn't, if you own shares in clubs which potentially could face each other in a match, that would cause issues as far as the individual leagues are concerned.
It's Company's House that you lodge accounts at, is it?
That's correct, yes.
So do you think every year at Company's House, on a quiet day, they'll be sitting there going, "Oh, Billy Ricky's coming in soon. This will be a laugh. That's the afternoon done."
I'd like to think so. It is a very automated system, so sadly, I don't think he will be high on their list. But talking about Company's House, it is the 1st of February, so we're celebrating 6 months overdue of Sheffield Wednesday submitting their 2019 accounts,
right,
which means that the fine the club's going to have to spend is double.
Oh, really?
And Sheffield Wednesday have also, by all accounts, failed to pay the wages in full for January. So you know, they are coming up on the rails of another club in the Championship in terms of being on the naughty step and perhaps getting too many mentions for their liking on this show.
All right. Well, Guy, if you are listening, or whoever it is you're paying less than minimum wage to edit this week's show, could pass on the message, put Sheffield Wednesday down for Thursday's news thing. I even as I said Company's House, I knew there was going to be a talking of Company's House. And let's face it, most of the time people at Company's House spend their moments going, "That's that bloke from Price of Football again. Has he not got a home to go to?" Our final question comes from Joe Yates, and I think the more perceptive among you would realise that this is going to be about sponsorship in some way, form or other. Joe Yates' question is about Alisher Usmanov. I'm never quite sure how you pronounce that first name, but he just puts Usmanov. Everton. He said Usmanov has invested a large amount of sponsorship into Everton's women's team. Will this count towards revenue for the men's team in FFP calculations, or are the women's accounts separate?
The women's accounts are separate. However, When you take a look at the consolidated or the umbrella accounts upon which FFP is based, anything which involves the women's team is ignored for FFP purposes. So the women's team can lose as much money or make as much money as it wants, but it's not going to qualify towards FFP. So the women's team is safe with regards to that. Mr. Usmanov's relationship with Everton is strange. Originally, he was a significant shareholder in Arsenal, and he then bought some further shares from Farhad Mashiri, who was another minority shareholder at Arsenal. Farhad Mashiri took the money he got from Usmanov and went out and bought Everton. Usmanov was trying to take over Arsenal, but he kept being pushed back. And the reason why was that the Arsenal's major shareholder, who's Stan Kroenke, he's about 65% of the company. Usmanov had 35%. Stan Kroenke wouldn't even let Usmanov sit on the board of directors, despite owning a third of the club. So Usmanov eventually, I think in accounting speak, we say, saw his arse. And left. So he got bought out by Kroenke. And since then, he has popped up in at Everton. So that he's now sponsoring the training facilities with his main company, which is an Eastern European metal exchange, which I'm not sure how it benefits from having its name above the gates at on Merseyside, but he's paid a huge sum of money for that. And also one of his other companies, which is a Russian telecoms company called Megafon, it is now sponsoring the Everton's women's shirts. So they've got the men's shirt, which is being sponsored by a car company because Everton stopped their deal with the gambling company.
Yes,
it's a topic we could return to at some point. Megafon have now got the women's TV team rights. And I think that's quite intriguing because we are starting to see some corporate entities take the view that as crowds and interest increases in women's football, that their brand probably fits in quite well in with the demographics of women's football, and they're starting to show more of an interest. And as far as women's football is concerned, nearly all of the money comes through commercial sales. If you take a look at the likes of Liverpool, for example, I think in 2019, their total ticket sales for the season generated £2,000, which is, they were having to build up interest in the team by giving tickets away. None of the women's teams are generating more than 127 grand in ticket sales. So that's an area of growth for the future. But commercial deals is certainly something which can be important today.
I've been with my accountant, little Bobby Numbers, for nigh on 30 years now. I've never heard him use the expression "saw his arse." You're some kind of renegade accountant. You casually say all accountants use these phrases. It's you. You mentioned the Russian telecoms company. There's another potential problem for Usmanov, and I guess potentially for Everton, in that there have been increasing calls in the past couple of days for investigations into Usmanov and Abramovich's links to Putin, and indeed calls for the FA and the Premier League to maybe look at sanctions for these two people.
Yes, they have. And this is linked to some of the pronouncements from the Russian opposition leader who has been poisoned and jailed by Putin's regime. He has said in some of his writings that both Abramovich and Usmanov have close links, and it doesn't reflect well on the Premier League in having such relationships. So trying to put pressure, the Premier League will go silent on this and say it doesn't get involved in politics unless it's Middle Eastern politics, funnily enough, and Newcastle. So, I think that this one could make the Premier League feel a little bit uncomfortable because, given what's happened to him, in terms of the absolutely appalling treatment by the Russian government, and as somebody that's probably still banned from going back to Russia, I'm quite happy to say that, then I think everybody should be trying to offer as much support as possible.
Yes, and finally, you mentioned gambling. Within the next week or so, we'll be having an interview with somebody who is an expert on the effects of gambling on young footballers in particular. I know it's an issue that agitates both of us, so I'm looking forward to that. In the meantime, if you have any questions for our next questions pod, which is Monday, a week today, for those of you listening on Monday, we've got the news on Thursday and questions next Monday. It's questions@priceoffootball.com, and that's a question on any aspect of football finance, no matter how big or small. We're open to all inquiries, as Kieran has been for most of his life. In the meantime, I think it's just about time for the first game to kick off, so I'm going to run in and have a sausage sandwich and watch that. I'll let Kieran say goodbye to you all.
Right, well, whilst Kevin's enjoying his sausage sandwich, and that's another Viz Profanosaurus special, of course. Once again, thanks for all the feedback, folks. If you could press the subscribe button. We have taken the mickey out of producer Guy, who is the world's sweetest man. We have to be perfectly honest here. But as he always says, the feedback on Apple Podcasts does make a difference. It helps us in the charts, and we are trying to book some interesting people to have a chat with, and it just adds to our credibility with them. It doesn't matter what you say. You can say that you'd rather Jiz Hornkamp and perhaps Bjork host the show as opposed to myself and Kevin. That makes no difference. If you give us the 5 stars, it does. Apart from that, stay safe, look after yourselves, and speak to your loved ones.
Yeah, I've met Bjork. Can I put a request in that maybe she doesn't co-host any of them? So, I mean, I would listen to it, certainly, but I don't think Guy would particularly want to produce it. Yes, in fact, I should have mentioned it on the news, our next pod on Thursday, we will be bringing you an interview from somebody from the NFL, from the 49ers, rather. The 49ers are in the NFL, but an interview with somebody from San Francisco 49ers about their increased investment in Leeds United, which should be interesting for all concerned. Until then, we'll see you later.
Bye-bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.